Chapter 2. The Late Bronze Age Collapse. Circa 1600 BCE to circa 1150 BCE. From the ashes of Sumer, a host of successors arose in the millennium that followed, and by 1200 BCE, the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea were ruled by a diverse scattering of kingdoms, minor empires, and city-states. Languages and cultures mingled as trade routes crisscrossed land and sea. Markets bustled in the thriving cities of Ugarit, Hattusha, Mycenae, and Babylon, and the Mediterranean experienced a golden age of literacy and culture. But within just a few decades, every one of these cities lay in ruins. Their stones were scattered, their libraries burned, their people left unburied in the streets. The world as it once was came to an end, and only ash and desolation were left behind. This was one of the worst disasters of ancient history, an event that historians have come to call the Late Bronze Age Collapse. And exactly what happened is still one of history's most fiercely debated mysteries. The ruins of the city of Hattusha are a melancholy sight. Crumbling walls of grey limestone stand out against the tawny yellow grassland and rocky outcrops of the surrounding hills. Even now, one look will tell you that Hattusha was once a mighty fortress, built in the rocky Çorum province of the Black Sea region of Turkey, within a great bend of the Kızılırmak River. Its double wall was defended by more than 100 towers, its thick gateways decorated with carved sculptures of lions. For centuries, this was the prosperous capital of the Hittite Empire. But if you were to dig down into the ruins of Hattusha, you would find a thin black layer right above the floor level of its buildings. This layer is made up of ash, charred wood, and rubble scorched in a fierce fire, and it dates to around 1200 BCE. Archaeology paints a picture of total destruction. Walls and roofs collapsed, bricks shattered and melted. After that event, the archaeological record ends. Except for occasional signs of a few scattered scavengers eking out an existence among the rubble, the ruins of Hattusha remained empty for centuries, a haunted place where it seems most feared to go. We find the same evidence 20 kilometers north of Hattusha, at the site of the ancient city of Alasahoyuk, where the Hittites buried their kings in opulent tombs. Like Hattusha, it is completely covered by ash and rubble at the same level. And 100 kilometers to the east of that, another fortified Hittite town known as Mashat Hoyuk, with a strong citadel and spacious palace, was also burned around the same time. In nearby Karauglan, you can find arrowheads littering the earth like fallen leaves, and the bones of men, women, and children left lying in the streets, right where they fell over 3,000 years ago. In fact, almost anywhere you go in the eastern Mediterranean, across an area spanning over 1,000 kilometers, you will find this layer of destruction. Archaeological evidence is quite explicit. At some point between 1200 and 1100 BCE, civilization in this region simply came to an end. The historian Robert Drews puts it succinctly. Within a period of 40 or 50 years at the end of the 13th and beginning of the 12th century, almost every significant city in the eastern Mediterranean world was destroyed, many of them never to be occupied again. It is safe to say that for a long time after the year 1200 BCE, there were no cities in the eastern Mediterranean area. It took some of these areas nearly 1,000 years to recover. Powerful and well-established empires, like those of the Hittites, Ugarit, the Minoans and the Mycenaean Greeks, collapsed so completely that they disappeared from the historical record altogether, and their descendants were left to live among the ruins. One of the ways in which the memory of the Late Bronze Age collapse may have survived is through the epic poetry that was composed about this time. The most famous of these relates the destruction of a walled city in the eastern Mediterranean called Troy. The epic poems known as the Iliad and Odyssey are attributed to the author Homer, who may or may not have existed. Recent scholarship now generally holds that these epics were passed down as oral poetry for centuries through the period known as the Greek Dark Ages, which followed the chaos of the Bronze Age collapse. These poems survived by word of mouth, with each poet-singer using astonishing skills of memory to recite them, lengthening and embellishing them along the way, until they were finally written down by an anonymous scribe around the 8th century BCE. The poetry of the Iliad especially relates the story of a 10-year war that took place in the eastern Mediterranean and which occupied much of the warrior classes of Greece. This war was supposedly led by Agamemnon, a king of the Greek city-state of Mycenae. In the 2nd millennium BCE, Mycenae was one of the major centers of Greek civilization. And from around 1400 to 1200 BCE was the predominant power of the Peloponnese. Lying about 90 kilometers southwest of Athens, it was a military stronghold that held sway from its mountainous perch overlooking the plains of Argos, and had a population of over 30,000 people at its height. Like Hattusha, its citadel gates were decorated with carved stone lions, and its people made armor out of ivory taken from the tusks of wild boars. Over a millennium later, in the 2nd century CE, the Greek travel writer Pausanias wrote breathlessly about his visit to its ruins, the large stones of which were so impressive that he believed them to have been built by giants. The wall, which is the only part of the ruins still remaining, is a work of the Cyclopes, made of unwrought stones, each stone being so big that a pair of mules could not move the smallest from its place to the slightest degree. Long ago, small stones were so inserted that each of them binds the large blocks firmly together. For a long time, it was thought that the Trojan War was an invention of a poet's imagination, and that the city of Troy itself was a myth. But that all changed with the discovery of the ruins of Troy at the end of the 19th century, at a place called Hisarlik, at the mouth of the Dardanelles in what is today Turkey. This location would have placed Troy on the periphery of the Hittite Empire and as a major rival to Mycenaean power. Many scholars now believe that the Trojan War, as related by Homer, does reflect real events, or at least a composite of real events, filtered through the lens of mythology and oral storytelling. The historian Eric Klein points out that a Hittite artifact known as the Milawata letter describes a conflict that seemingly occurred between the Hittites and the Mycenaeans over a city that they called Willusa, which may have been the Greek Ilion or Troy. This conflict may not have been particularly large, but in the time between the real event and the writing of the epics, the entire region underwent the catastrophe of the collapse. Over that period, these epics may have preserved, at least in hazy form, an authentic memory of those days. Not just a clash between two powerful Bronze Age empires, but the feeling of apocalypse that must have washed over the region. The trauma of a period of warfare and destruction that seemed to dwarf all others. The site of Troy has now been extensively excavated, and we have learned that throughout the Bronze Age, Troy was indeed a grand city, much as Homer describes. It was topped with an impressively fortified citadel, and contained artifacts that suggest trade links to the Hittites, Assyrians, and Babylonians. This layer of the city's archaeology is known as Troy 6, and it lasted from about 1750 BCE until about 1300 BCE. According to the Greek epics, its walls were built by the gods Poseidon and Apollo, and in reality they were certainly impressive, 9 meters high, with towers soaring up to 18 meters. Around the citadel, replete with royal palaces, a long curtain wall enclosed a larger urban area. But unfortunately for historians, the ruins of Troy are strangely silent. That is, there has been almost no writing uncovered in any excavations of the city, and it's unclear even what language the people of Troy spoke. The grand royal city of Troy 6 was destroyed around the year 1300 BCE, possibly by an earthquake. There is widespread damage to the foundations of the buildings and some sign of fire damage to the city's stones. But others argue that it could have been sacked, and that this is the event that Homer's Iliad remembers. After this disaster, people rebuilt many of the monumental palaces and re-inhabited the city in a somewhat diminished form. But then, around 1190 BCE, the city was burned again, right as that wave of destruction passed over the whole region. Here, significant traces of fire can be found on its stones, while human remains were found in houses and in the streets. Near its northwestern ramparts, a human skeleton with skull injuries and a broken jawbone was unearthed, and bronze arrowheads litter the ground in the citadel. In fact, it seems Troy was burned twice towards the end of the 13th century BCE. It's not clear who the perpetrators of this massacre were, but we can imagine that the poetry of the Iliad captures something of the violence of warfare in that time. Then rose two mingled shouts and groans of men. Slaying and slain, the earth ran red with blood. As when, descending from the mountain's brow, two wintry torrents from their copious source pour downwards to the narrow pass, where meet their mingled waters in some deep ravine, the weight of flood on the far mountain's side, the shepherd hears the roar. So loud arose the shouts and yells of the commingling hosts. The Hittitologist Trevor Bryce speculates that it was this final abandonment of Troy's population centre that inspired Greek poet singers to assemble the material of the Iliad. All this contributed to the making of the epic, a long tradition of conflicts between Western Anatolian peoples and the Mycenaean Greeks. The final abandonment of the citadel of this state, they now saw before them Troy's ultimate fate, its destruction and abandonment. The Greek city-state of Mycenae would itself face a similar fate. By 1200 BCE, its power was waning. But then, within a short time, all the palace complexes of southern Greece, including Mycenae, were burned to the ground. But before we go into the causes of the Bronze Age collapse, we need to understand what was lost. This vibrant and varied region that had prospered for so many centuries and fell so completely and so suddenly. We often make the mistake of thinking about the ancient world as a series of insular and isolated states. And it's true that their worlds were smaller than ours, the known world for someone living in the Eastern Mediterranean around 1200 BCE would have extended from Greece to perhaps the Zagros Mountains of western Iran. It was populated by the Mycenaean people of Greece in the west and the new kingdom of Egypt in the south, which was just emerging from a period of civil war. It took in the islands of Cyprus and Crete, as well as coastal cities along the Levantine coast, like the Phoenician city of Byblos, then an Egyptian colony, and the wealthy port city-state of Ugarit. To the east, in the verdant marshes of southern Iraq, the city of Babylon was at that time ruled by a dynasty known as the Kassites, and to the north of them was the bellicose empire of Assyria, which governed the plains of northern Iraq and Syria. These kingdoms, empires, and city-states could be suspicious and rivalrous, and often went to war. But this wasn't the whole story. The societies of the Bronze Age were in many ways as entangled and interdependent as the nation-states of our globalized world today. Firstly, trade across the Mediterranean Sea was essential to the economies of these civilizations. One shipwreck found off the coast of Uluburun in southwestern Turkey offers a glimpse into the rich exchange of materials that occurred during this time. Built of Lebanese cedarwood, the ship has been dated to about 1300 BCE and was likely sailing to a Mycenaean port when it sunk. Among its cargo, archaeologists found 10 tons of copper smelted into more than 350 ingots, 1 ton of tin, logs of ebony, elephant and hippo tusks, along with more than a dozen hippopotamus teeth, a jar filled with glass beads, more with olives and terebinth resin, almonds, pistachios, figs, grapes and coriander, whole pomegranates, and a golden scarab beetle inscribed with the name of the Egyptian queen Nefertiti. Arrowheads, daggers, turtle shells and ostrich eggs, quartz crystals and gold, pottery and oil lamps from Cyprus, along with blocks of raw coloured glass in cobalt blue and lavender. Altogether, goods from at least 7 different lands. It's easy to see how this rich trade would have drawn all these disparate civilizations together. People, too, passed between them. We know that Minoan artists from Crete, for instance, came to decorate the walls of Egyptian palaces in the pharaonic naval base of Perunefer. Kings requested the services of physicians, artisans, weavers, musicians, and singers from other kingdoms. And intermarriage was also fairly common, especially among the elites. To give just one example, we know from court records that Amurapi, the last king of Ugarit, married and subsequently went through a bitter and lengthy divorce with a Hittite woman. While much of the trade in the region was in luxury goods, other materials that flowed down these trade routes were utterly essential to the survival of these large, complex nations. And of all these, the most critical Bronze Age resource was, of course, the one that gives the era its name. Bronze is a reddish-gold alloy of copper and tin, on a roughly 10-to-1 ratio. It was the sharpest and hardest metal yet available. And since its discovery, sometime in the 4th millennium BCE, had become critical to the manufacture of just about every weapon, tool, and household object. Like aluminium or steel today, it had become completely indispensable to the societies it supported. Without a steady supply of high-quality bronze, armies could have no weapons, chariot wheels would go rimless, craftsmen would have no tools. The historian Carol Bell describes this early period of globalized supply. The availability of enough tin to produce what I like to call weapons-grade bronze must have exercised the minds of the great king in Hattusha and the pharaoh in Thebes, in the same way that supplying gasoline to the American SUV driver at reasonable cost, preoccupies an American president today. For the manufacture of all this bronze, copper was relatively easy to find, but tin was a rare metal. At the time, the primary source was a series of mines in the Badakhshan region of Afghanistan. From there, it had to be brought overland on caravans of donkeys, following the ancient route that would one day be known as the Silk Road. It was a long and perilous route that crossed mountains and rivers until it reached the cities of Mesopotamia. From there, the cargo of tin spread out across the region and over the sea to Greece. Studies of isotope and chemical composition have even shown that tin mined in southwestern England, in the present-day counties of Devon and Cornwall, was making its way into the furnaces of the Near East around this time. The entire military might of the region's superpowers, Egypt, Assyria, the Hittites, Ugarit, Babylon, and Mycenae, all depended on these precarious supplies, which must have felt at the time as fragile as a cobweb. Tied together by these interrelations of trade and supply, these nations were not entirely distinct and separate entities, so much as a complex and entangled mesh of societies, each as dependent on each other as the next. While peace largely held in the region, and trade could continue, they achieved a kind of stability. But for a number of reasons, peace wasn't to last. When casting around for the causes of the late Bronze Age collapse, historians have long alighted on one particular set of culprits. These they refer to as the Sea Peoples, a moniker coined in the 19th century. This name seems to evoke something terrifying and foreign, like monsters rising up from the depths to wreak devastation on the land. Who exactly the Sea Peoples were, where they came from, or what language they spoke, are all uncertain. Many historians have offered their guesses, ranging from Sardinia and Sicily to Libya or the Aegean, or closer by in the eastern Mediterranean. But wherever they originated, one thing is certain. Around the time of the Great Collapse, these invaders began landing on the shores of the eastern Mediterranean in large numbers and with fearsome force. An account of this armada is given on the walls of the mortuary temple of Pharaoh Ramesses III at Medinet Habu, near the Valley of the Kings. The northerners in their isles were disturbed, taken away in the fray at one time. Not one stood before their hands. From Keta, Kode, Carchemish, Arvad, Alassa, they all were wasted. They desolated his people, and his land was like that which is not. These lands were united, and they laid their hands upon the land as far as the circle of the earth. Their hearts were confident, full of their plans. At least some of the societies that caved in at the end of the Bronze Age fell because of this single cause. One example is the city-state of Ugarit, a booming trade city whose ruins lie at the site of Ras Shamra, on the coast of northern Syria. Ugarit had ruled over a small coastal kingdom of merchants and sailors for at least 6 centuries. It stood at the very end of the trade routes that snaked across the Asian landmass and dispersed goods from its port all over the Mediterranean. Ships full of all the items found nestled in the hold of the Uluburun shipwreck would have passed through Ugarit, and each one of them would have been taxed. With this wealth, its citizens built a resplendent city by the sea. Like most successful trading towns, Ugarit was multicultural and diverse, using at least 7 languages in its records. It was a city in love with the written word, and it kept expansive libraries in its palaces and temples. It even fostered some of the earliest known private libraries. one of which we know belonged to a diplomat named Rapanu. To Ugarit, we owe the oldest surviving complete piece of written music in the world, a hymn dedicated to the moon goddess Nikkal, which can still be played today. But this prosperity was soon to come to an end. In Ugarit, archaeologists have found a clay tablet containing a letter from King Amurapi. In it, he begs the ruler of nearby Cyprus to come to his aid. "My father, behold, the enemy's ships came here. My cities were burned, and they did evil things in my country. Does not my father know that all my troops and chariots are in the land of Hatti, and all my ships are in the land of Lucca? Thus, the country is abandoned to itself. May my father know it. The 7 ships of the enemy that came here inflicted much damage upon us." No help arrived, because the letter was never sent. It burned along with the rest of the city, its clay baked hard in the flames. The city was destroyed so utterly that it was never reoccupied. When excavating the ruins of Ugarit, archaeologists have found a layer of destruction that lies 2 meters thick in places, made of ash and broken brick. Roofs are caved in and scorched, and like Hattusha, its streets are scattered with arrowheads. People buried their valuables in panic and never returned to dig them up. Since most of Ugarit's forces were stationed elsewhere when the attack occurred, we can tell just how much it took them by surprise. Across the region, it seems the Sea Peoples deployed the same tactics. They appeared without warning, wreaked havoc, sacked cities, and then disappeared over the horizon before anyone knew what had happened. These coastal communities had been menaced by pirates for centuries, but this was on a whole different scale. Other cities along the coast, like Mersin, Tarsus, and Ascalon, suffered the same fate. And even those some way inland, like Hazor in the hills of Upper Galilee, and the city of Yamhad on the site of the Syrian city of Aleppo. The island of Cyprus, to whom the king of Ugarit had hoped to send his plea for help, didn't fare any better. On the Bronze Age site of Kokinokremos in the south of the island, archaeologists have found evidence that the whole town was abandoned in a hurry. The bronze smith buried his tools in the courtyard of his workshop. The silversmith hid his silver between 2 slabs of a stone bench, while the goldsmith hid all his sheet gold in a pit. What happens to these artisans, we may never know, but they never returned to retrieve their precious things. For a long time, historians were content to attribute the collapse of many complex societies all at once to the Sea Peoples. These marauders themselves left no written sources, and precious few material traces have ever been conclusively connected to them. But a little unusually, we do actually have a pretty good idea of what the Sea Peoples looked like. That's thanks to the sprawling low-relief carving that Pharaoh Ramesses III chose to adorn the outer wall of his mortuary temple at Medinet Habu, on the west bank of the Nile, opposite Luxor in Upper Egypt. The detailed carved relief shows a number of prisoners taken from the Sea Peoples, men wiry and tall and wearing kilts, with some sporting a distinctive kind of headdress that looks like a sheaf of feathers or reeds, fixed in place with a chin strap. Others wear skull caps or horned helmets. These variations in their appearance point to a loose confederation of different peoples, choosing to sail under the same banner. While we don't know where they came from, some of the names of these peoples are known to us from the inscriptions. The Danuna, the Cheker, the Pelasset, the Shardana, and the Weshesh. These were seemingly a loose coalition, and no leaders or kings are ever mentioned. Evidence suggests that at least some of the ethnic groups that made up the Sea Peoples weren't unfamiliar to the Egyptians. In fact, it seems some had sought employment in Egyptian courts and armies in the past, and there's some evidence that they had had diplomatic contact over perhaps as much as a few centuries before the collapse occurred. The Chardana people, who may have originated in Sardinia, had even supplied mercenaries to the pharaohs, and their distinctive pointed helmets can also be seen in a painting on the walls of the temple of Abu Simbel in Egypt's far south. But whoever they were, one thing is for certain. Wherever the Sea Peoples went, destruction followed. During the Bronze Age collapse, we can effectively place the nations of the Eastern Mediterranean into two categories. First, there are those that cave completely under the pressure of the time and disappear, leaving only ruins behind. Into that group we can place Mycenae, the Hittites, Ugarit, and others. In the second category are the civilizations that survive, albeit in a diminished and weakened form. These are the empires of Egypt and Assyria. Assyria survived the coming onslaught by cutting its losses. It withdrew from all its less defensible territories and fell back to its imperial heartland between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, recoiling like a tortoise in its shell. The example of Egypt is more interesting, and the man who is perhaps most responsible for its survival is the pharaoh of the time, Ramesses III. Ramesses was a determined and tenacious ruler. Looking at the perfectly preserved mummy uncovered in the Valley of the Kings, it's easy to imagine his appearance in life, his high cheekbones and tall, narrow forehead that give him a cerebral air, and inscriptions hint at him as a builder, a devotee to the gods, and a statesman. Ramesses was the son of a usurper, a man named Setnakhte, who had seized the throne in a bloody civil war and begun the 20th dynasty of Egypt. Setnakhte managed to rule for only 4 years before his death in 1186 BCE. When the crown passed to the young Ramesses, as the later inscriptions recount, "The gods have appointed me to be king over Egypt. They decreed to me the kingdom while I was a child, and my reign is full of plenty." This new pharaoh must have felt a pressure to prove himself, perhaps reflected in the name he ruled under. The last pharaoh to hold the name Ramesses was Ramesses the Great, who had ruled Egypt for 67 years during the golden age of the New Kingdom, almost a century before. This new Ramesses clearly idolized this ancient king. Not only did he name all his sons after his predecessor's sons, but also gave them the same positions in court. Though we have only his own inscriptions to go by, it seems Ramesses III was a relatively benevolent ruler. He mentions planting trees to increase the shade along the harsh desert roads and protecting the rights of women so that they didn't fear walking in the streets, as well as allowing soldiers to go home to their families during peacetime. He sent expeditions across the Red Sea to Yemen, where he discovered long-lost copper mines that boosted Egypt's wealth and also brought back rare plants in pots to cultivate in his gardens. Under other circumstances, he might have been one of Egypt's great rulers. When news of the Sea People's attacks came to Ramesses, he would have been pharaoh for about 8 years. He had already repelled 2 invasions from Libya and must have been rising in confidence, but the news must have troubled him. He resolved that his kingdom would not share in the fate of its neighbors. Egypt couldn't react to the threat in the way the Assyrians had, by retreating inland and consolidating their defenses. It had a long Mediterranean coast, making it vulnerable to invasion from the sea, and maritime trade was the backbone of its economy. Still, the ancient Egyptians had a poor reputation when it came to naval prowess. They were essentially a land-going power, and usually left the messy business of watery warfare to smaller powers like the Phoenicians. The Egyptians were used to dominating battlefields with vast assemblages of archers and swift units of horse-drawn chariots to sow panic and break enemy lines. This required, of course, a large open battlefield. Since members of Sea People's groups had served in Egyptian armies in the past, perhaps they knew this weakness. The Sea Peoples seem to have known that the best way to neutralize Egypt's tactics would be an attack on its very lifeblood. All of Egypt's great cities lay on the Nile, and if Egyptian resistance was broken on the river, they would fall one by one, leaving their riches open for the taking. Ramesses knew they would have to be stopped, and he chose as his battleground the lush, fertile Nile Delta. Red lotuses bloom here in the autumn, and papyrus sedges grow along the banks. Back then, Nile crocodiles and hippopotamuses still ranged wild. Ramesses would have to play to what strengths the Egyptian army still had in this challenging terrain. Informed by scouts of the Sea People's approach, he decided to lay an ambush and give the Sea Peoples a surprise attack of their own, as he recounts in his Medinet Habu inscription. "Now it happened, through this god, the lord of gods, that I was prepared and armed to trap them like wild fowl. I equipped my frontier in Zahi, prepared before them. The chiefs, the captains of infantry, the nobles, I caused to equip the harbor mouths like a strong wall, with warships, galleys, and barges." As the enemy's ships amassed, Ramesses gathered archers on the banks, supported by spearmen and cavalry in their thousands, concealed in the reeds, all of them soldiers of the choicest of Egypt, being like lions roaring upon the mountaintops. Ramesses even remembers the horses quivering in every limb, ready to crush the countries under their feet. The tension must have been tremendous. All the soldiers of the Egyptian army holding their breath and waiting for that first sign of an enemy ship to come in from the sea. Then, at last, a ship came around the bend in the river. After that came another and another, until the whole seaborne might of the Sea Peoples was in sight. The Egyptians must have been able to hear the creak of 10,000 oars, the beating of the drums, the shouts of the helmsmen and soldiers. Then, once the Sea People's ships were within range, Ramesses unleashed hell. Arrows flew out of the reeds and rained down on the ships of the Sea Peoples. Panicked, the invaders attempted to land on the banks. But as they did, the Egyptian lancemen appeared out of the tree line and met them. While the enemy was held at bay, trapped and frantic on the river, the Egyptian navy sailed in and struck. They used grappling hooks to haul in the enemy ships. The chaos of this battle is encapsulated in the carvings at Medinet Habu. Men are shown impaled on spears, clambering onto the sides of ships, ducking arrows that whiz overhead. Boats overturn, spilling men into the river. Bodies float face down in the frothing water. In the brutal hand-to-hand struggle, the Sea Peoples were overwhelmed. Ramesses III's inscription recounts the fury of the battle. "Those who reached my boundary, their heart and their soul are finished forever and ever. As for those who had assembled before them on the sea, the full flame was in their front, before the harbor mouths, and a wall of metal upon the shore surrounded them. They were dragged, overturned, and laid low upon the beach, slain and made heaps from stern to bow of their galleys, while all their things were cast upon the water. Thus I turned back the waters to remember Egypt. When they even mention my name in their land, may it consume them with fear. Ramesses' plan had worked. The Egyptians were the first people to turn back these sea-going invaders and stop their campaign of destruction. His inscription at Medinet Habu ends on the following triumphant note. Rejoice ye, O Egypt, to the height of heaven, for I am ruler of the south and north upon the throne of Atum. I have expelled your mourning which was in your heart, and I have made you dwell in peace. Those whom I have overthrown shall not return. Some of the sea peoples seem to have landed in the region of Canaan as well, and the Egyptians hunted them down and defeated them here too. But this victory alone would not save Egypt. The land of the pharaohs now stood alone in a devastated region. Virtually every land around them had been gutted and reduced to ash. Numerous established civilizations, the Mycenaeans, the Hittites, Ugarit, Babylon, had collapsed, and civil order had given way to chaos. The precarious trade routes on which they had all relied were now broken, and Egypt's economy went into a steep and unstoppable decline. By the end of the Late Bronze Age collapse, Egypt was utterly diminished, a shadow of its former self. As other enemies encroached on its borders, Egypt was able to fight them off, but its treasury became so depleted that it never fully recovered its imperial power. The first labor strike in recorded history happened during the 29th year of Ramesses III's reign, when Egypt could no longer provide food rations for its elite artisans, constructing the king's tomb in the village of Deir el-Medina. 20 days have elapsed in the month, and rations have not been given, complained one official. The lack of rations went on so long that the workers eventually marched through the town, chanting, "We're hungry. There is no more clothing, no more oil, no more fish, no more vegetables. Send word to the pharaoh." If food was not reaching these crucial workers, we can only imagine the situation in the wider kingdom. Ramesses III ruled for a total of 31 years, but he died in 1156 BCE, murdered by members of his own household. His death was followed by years of bickering among his heirs. Three of his sons would become king at different times, reigning as Ramesses IV, Ramesses VI, and Ramesses VIII. Meanwhile, Egypt was increasingly beset by droughts, lack of seasonal floodwaters, famines, civil unrest, and official corruption. As the power of the pharaoh waned, that of the priests in Thebes grew, and the last pharaoh of the dynasty, Ramesses XI, had such a weak grasp on power that the priests essentially became the true rulers of the kingdom. The Egyptian empire finally fractured, less than 80 years after Ramesses III's reign, and never regained its former power. Historians have long found the sea peoples a convenient culprit for the destruction that occurred across this region. But at other sites, the story is a little more complicated. The city-state of Mycenae and all its satellite cities were certainly wiped out around the 13th century BCE. But it's not clear that this was the work of the sea peoples. Modern archaeologists credit this destruction to a more mundane source, the Mycenaeans' belligerent northern neighbors, the Dorians. It's thought that Mycenae was first weakened and distracted by sea people attacks, before their neighboring rivals smelled blood and moved in for the kill. The Hittite capital of Hattusha, where we opened this story, is another example. It lies far inland in the mountains of Turkey, and it wasn't a likely target for coastal raiders. The more likely perpetrators are their long-term rivals, the Cascians, the Phrygians, or the Brigas. These invaders could have seen their opportunity when the Sea Peoples disrupted Mediterranean trade routes, caused shortages in the crucial tin supply, and instigated a famine in Hittite lands. States of this era depended heavily on their allies to help them when they were threatened. But when numerous states found themselves under simultaneous threat, those alliances suddenly became ineffective, and everyone was left vulnerable. Babylon, in particular, fell prey to the alliance problem. Babylon was one of the most ancient and powerful cities in the region, located about 100 kilometers south of modern Baghdad. It was ruled by a 500-year dynasty known as the Kassites. The Kassites had long depended on their allies in Assyria and the coastal regions to help defend it. But now these nations were busy defending themselves, and Babylon stood alone. To their north was the land of Elam, a hardy people who lived in the mountains of southern Iran and had been causing trouble for the people of Mesopotamia since the Sumerian age. The Elamite king Kutur-Nahunte believed that the crown of Babylon belonged to him, as his father had before him. The previous king had threatened Babylon before with fearsome rhetoric. "Why, I, who am a king, son of a king, seed of a king, scion of a king, why do I not sit on the throne of Babylonia? I sent you a sincere proposal. You, however, have granted me no reply. You may climb up to heaven, but I'll pull you down by your hem. You may go down to hell, but I'll pull you up by your hair. I shall destroy your cities, demolish your fortresses, stop up your irrigation ditches, cut down your orchards." Kutur-Nahunte led a successful invasion into Babylonia in the year 1158 BCE and went on to make good on what he had promised. None of Babylon's allies seemed able to help them. While Babylon burned, its last Kassite king was led to Elam in chains, along with a beloved statue of the Babylonian god Marduk. So, although the Sea Peoples undoubtedly played a role in the collapse, we can see that the situation in this region wasn't always so straightforward. The archaeology of the end of the Bronze Age paints a picture of large and complex empires suddenly faltering when faced with smaller and less complex belligerents on their borders. It was a seismic shift in the way power was organized in the Eastern Mediterranean. It was long thought that part of this shift must have been the proliferation of iron weapons, which would in the centuries to come bring the Age of Bronze to an end. Iron had been in limited use since as early as 3000 BCE, and early people even worked the iron they found in meteorites. But iron is much harder to work than copper and tin, requiring more heat and thus more powerful furnaces. The knowledge of how to turn iron into steel, mixing it with the right proportion of carbon in the form of charcoal, would further transform it into a metal that was just as sharp and hard as bronze, but much cheaper and less dependent on fragile long-range supply networks. In the second millennium BCE, only great nations with access to complex trade networks could forge bronze, but as steel-making technologies proliferated, soon even tribal societies and tiny kingdoms could afford cutting-edge weaponry, smelted from what seemed like the very stones of the earth. Around this time, a new kind of sword, referred to by archaeologists as the Nawa Type II or Griptongue sword, arrived in the region from southeastern Europe, first in bronze, but soon being wrought out of iron. It has been suggested that the effect may have been not dissimilar to the introduction of cheap assault rifles like the AK-47 in our own time, acting as a military leveler that allowed non-state actors to destabilize whole regions. However, more recent metallurgical archaeology has undermined this view, and most evidence shows that iron weapons were still a relative rarity in this region at the point that the crisis of the collapse was reaching its climax. The historian Robert Drews argues that the catastrophe may somehow or other have contributed to the development of an ironworking technology, but it could not have been the other way around. As a result, historians are left looking for other explanations. Some have even attempted to reconfigure the roles in this drama. They ask, what if the Sea Peoples weren't the villains? What if they weren't the perpetrators in the collapse of civilization, but another set of victims? This last theory offers us an intriguing opportunity to shift our perspectives completely. Amid all the uncertainty, one thing we know for sure about the end of the 13th century BCE is that the climate of the Eastern Mediterranean underwent a sudden and lasting change. A study of fossilized pollen particles taken from sediments at the bottom of the Sea of Galilee has shown that a succession of severe droughts occurred over a 150-year period. The most striking feature in the entire Sea of Galilee pollen record appears at the end of the Late Bronze Age, between 1250 to 1100 BCE. This time interval is characterized by the lowest arboreal vegetation percentages throughout the entire sequence. This event probably lasted slightly more than a century and is therefore a relatively prolonged event, the most pronounced dry episode during the Bronze and Iron Ages. During this time, formerly verdant lands became dry and arid, and more plants suited to desert landscapes flourished. Analysis of sediment cores and oxygen isotopes in mineral deposits in Israeli caves have all shown that the 13th and 12th centuries BCE saw much less rain than the preceding centuries. Alongside this scientific evidence, we can see marks of severe droughts and famines in the region's written records too. The Hittites in their dry, stony mountains were hit particularly hard. Letters from Ugarit tell of sending large quantities of grain up the hill roads to feed populous cities like Hattusha. In the mid-13th century BCE, one Hittite queen sent a message to the Egyptian pharaoh, asking him to send her a shipment of grain. Other tablets sent to the king of Ugarit discuss famine. Another thing, my lord, grain staples from you are not to be had. The people of the household of your servant will die of hunger. My lord, give grain staples to your servant. There had been famines and droughts in the region before. They were simply a fact of life for people living in the precarious reality of the Bronze Age. But the climate change that occurred around this time was so severe and lasting that scientists have been prompted to search for some explanation. One answer might lie nearly 4,000 kilometers to the north, over the stormy waters of the North Atlantic, on the snowy slopes of southern Iceland. This is a harsh tundra landscape over which the shadow of an enormous volcano looms. Its name is Hekla, and it is one of Iceland's most active volcanoes. In the ancient and medieval imagination, it was thought to be the gate to hell and the prison where the traitor Judas was tormented. The Cistercian monk Herbert of Clairvaux wrote about the volcano in the 12th century CE that Mount Etna, the renowned fiery cauldron of Sicily, which men call Hell's Chimney, that cauldron is affirmed to be like a small furnace compared to this enormous inferno. Although an exact dating has not yet been possible, we know that sometime in the region of 1200 to 1000 BCE, Hekla had its most cataclysmic eruption to date. Known as Hekla 3, this eruption threw nearly 7.5 cubic kilometers of volcanic rock into the atmosphere and covered the sky in a dark shroud of ash particles that persisted for years after the event. Studies looking at the growth rings of bog oaks in Ireland, trees half fossilized in acidic marshy waters, have shown that for 18 years after Hekla 3, the trees barely grew at all. Across the Atlantic in the United States, bristlecone pines, the oldest living trees on Earth, provide similar evidence of this time of widespread darkness and cooling, which lasted about 2 decades. Some Egyptologists and archaeologists have firmly dated this cataclysm to the time of the Bronze Age collapse, and point to it as a cause of the rapid and dramatic climate change. It is certainly a tempting theory that offers an explanation for a time of extreme drought, famine, and unrest, as dark clouds may have blotted out the sun. One letter, sent from the king of the kingdom of Amuru, a neighbor of Ugarit around modern Lebanon, cryptically blames the storm god Adad for the deaths of some notables. "May all be well for you. May the gods protect you. Behold this matter which happened, how Adad killed many of my forces and nobles." Others have proposed that a volcanic eruption in Sicily around 1300 BCE may have been to blame, or that the supervolcano in Santorini, which had erupted devastatingly around 1600 BCE, may have resumed some activity. The cause may not even have been volcanic at all, and could have been due to variations in the sun's activity, or weather systems in the Atlantic, depriving the Mediterranean of moisture. The reality then was much as it is today. The planet's climate system is fragile, interconnected, and chaotic, and even relatively small changes in its equilibrium can have devastating effects. While these hypotheses are all subject to much lively debate and study, they do at least encourage us to reevaluate our notion of the Sea Peoples as a marauding armada. Were the Sea Peoples, in fact, refugees themselves? Imagine you are a citizen of an island in the Mediterranean, say Sardinia or Sicily. One year the sky turns dim. The sun peeks through the grey haze a pale white. There's drought too, and the crops won't grow. Starvation begins to set in on your island, and chaos spreads. There are riots for food. Everywhere, people are saying that the gods are angry, that the world is dying. The next year at harvest time, it's the same story. And now waves of people begin to arrive, hungry people from the far north, where the sun is even dimmer, where the worst winters in living memory are ravaging the lands. What do you do? Do you stay and hope the sun comes back? Hope that the crops grow next year? Do you hope that your new, hungry neighbors are friendly? Or do you band together and do one of the things you do best? Take to the sea. You would start small, sailing from place to place, trying to find somewhere the gods haven't abandoned. But it's the same everywhere. Society is disintegrating in the wake of years-long droughts and famines. And wherever you go, more people join your ranks. As your number swells, you become powerful. You resort to theft. You steal from merchant vessels and then small villages. You capture prisoners and gain even more recruits. Your strength grows and grows until you become an army of the sea. It seems no one can stand in your way. A roving band of refugee warriors roaming the oceans in search of somewhere to call home. For me, this makes sense of the mystery of the Sea Peoples, of how such a force of diverse peoples suddenly looms up seemingly from nowhere, with no direction or command structure. We can imagine the Sea Peoples as anarchic and opportunistic, probably changing leaders frequently, likely with a variety of opposing motivations and goals, Some would have wanted to find land to settle, others just to loot and burn. The centuries of drought had weakened many of the states they targeted and softened them up for attack. When the Sea Peoples met their end in the shady shallows of the Nile Delta, they must have felt the utter hopelessness of their situation bear down on them. They were people without a land, who had wrought so much destruction on the lands of others. We know that some of the Sea Peoples, at least, escaped elimination in the Egyptian marshes. One of the groups that made up their wandering army settled in the region of what is today Gaza, in the southern Levant, and put down roots. They were known as the Peleset, whom the Hebrews later called the Peleshet, and we today call the Philistines. They would come to be remembered as one of the great rivals to the kingdom of Israel and Judah, and gave their name to the later province of Palestine. Whatever the truth of their origins, or what happened to cause the sudden shift in the region's climate, these first dominoes to fall set off a series of cascading failures that passed through the societies of the Bronze Age. What happened next was what the historian Eric Klein describes as a perfect storm of calamities. This is what would have led to the rapid disintegration of one society after another, in part because of the fragmentation of the global economy and the breakdown of the interconnections upon which each civilization was dependent. In short, the flourishing cultures and peoples of the Bronze Age were simply not able to survive the onslaught of so many different stressors all at the same time. The Bronze Age collapse left the cities of the Eastern Mediterranean in ruins, its populations scattered, and whole cultures like the Mycenaean Greeks and the Hittites vanished for good. But even after this catastrophe, renewal came, and slowly people rebuilt from the rubble, like the first sprouts pushing through the ash of a recent forest fire. It's in the period following the Bronze Age collapse that peoples like the Assyrians, Phoenicians, Greeks, and even Romans sought the roots of their own civilizations and found opportunities to rise. For those peoples, the Bronze Age collapse was not an end, but a beginning. And classical antiquity, as we recognize it, began to take form. One Hittite text, which has come down to us in several fragments, seems to capture the spirit of this age, and it is known as the myth of Telepinu. It's a text that adheres to a poetic convention known as the vanishing god myth, in which a certain deity is so offended by the misdeeds of humanity that he flies into a rage or a fit of sorrow and abandons his duties, leaving the world desolate. Telepinu is a god of farming and fertility, and perhaps also of the weather. The beginning of the text has been lost to us, so we don't know what it was that provoked his rage. But the poem describes its deadly consequences, as crops fail, animals cease to breed, ash and soot clog the air, and drought and famine beset the world. Thereupon soot beset the windows, smoke beset the house. The ashes lay crammed on the hearth, off-stalked Telepinu. Grain and increase and abundance he took away from the field and meadow. Off to the copses stalked Telepinu, and in a copse he buried himself. Forthwith the seed ceased to yield produce. Forthwith oxen, sheep, and men ceased to breed, while even those that had conceived did not bear. Hillsides were bare, trees were bare, and put forth no new branches. Pastures were bare, springs ran dry. A famine arose in the land, men and gods alike were about to perish of hunger. With all hope fading, gods and mortals alike perform a number of rituals to placate the rage of Telepinu, and little by little he is soothed. Life returns to the ravaged land, and the people are able to rebuild. Life, as it always does, goes on. So Telepinu returned to his house. He took thought for his land. The window said goodbye to soot. The house said goodbye to smoke. The shrines of the gods were restored to good state. The hearth said goodbye to the ashes that were piled upon it. He released the sheep which were in the fold. He released the oxen which were in the stall. Mother once again nursed child. Ewe nursed lamb. Cow nursed calf. In the presence of Telepinu, an evergreen was set up, and from it was hung the fleece of a sheep. Enwrapped in that fleece were the fat of a sheep, grain of corn, fruit of the vine, symbolizing increase of oxen and sheep, continuance of life, and assurance of prosperity.